You're listening to the oneofus.net podcast network.
Hey, Chris, what are you drinking there?
Oh, you never seen one of these before?
No, what is that?
Oh, man, this is a brewery in Austin, Circle Brewing. They're right near my house, right up on Breaker Road. They got their own brewery with a bunch of stuff. This is actually, you're gonna think I'm lying. This is, I think, the best American Hefeweizen I've ever had, Circle Brewer.
Get out.
It's made in America. Yeah, yeah.
Wow. That's high praise coming from you.
Well, take a sip of this thing. Try that.
All right, let me see.
No. That wasn't the Hefeweizen. That was the IPA.
Yeah, no, that was the fantastic.
Ladybird. Yeah, that's good, too. Man, they make a lot of good beers. And like I said, you can come visit them at their tap room right down the street here from me on Breaker Lane. It's delicious stuff, and they actually became the sponsor for the website, oneofus.net.
Wow, good guys, and they live right down the street from here?
They certainly do, and you can even get their beer in convenience stores now.
Ah, convenience store. I'm going to just walk over to Circle.
Sup, brother? You ready to rock?
Oh, I'm ready to rock!
Dude, I got some lines. You're going to get a bump from this, and then we're going to pour down some whiskey, and then we're going to see an exploding cooch all over the place. It's going to be awesome!
Yeah!
Gosh. Well, this is the dirt, everybody. This is a Netflix-produced movie about Motley Crue, adapted from their own biography, actually, believe it or not. This is a book that all four of them wrote with another person, so.
Oh, was the other person in the movie? Or?
No, it just, you know, they got someone to help consult with the writing of the book.
Oh, kind of like a ghostwriter, okay.
Yeah, yeah, but basically, you know, so people don't know, this story is all about the formation and the insane career of Motley Crue, I guess, would you consider them like hair metal is kind of the genre that they belong to, or?
I would say so. I mean, they had the outfits, the presentation of the anarchy, the pushing the limits, the whales, and I'd say spectacle. That's the word. Yeah.
Oh, they're all like sparks and flames and crazy outfits. I mean, it's funny because I thought they wouldn't address the fact it's like, yeah, this is that era when people couldn't tell the women from the men. But that's a constant joke they make after a certain point. Just like, oh, man, look at the new girlfriend. Wait, which one's the girl in that group? You know, it's just like, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, basically, this is straight out of the Bohemian Rhapsody, straight out of Compton playbook. It's a movie where you follow the origins where you see all the the band members, you know, find their, you know, you see their background, you see how they met each other, you see where they come up with their iconic moments and that kind of thing. And then it's the rise and fall and rise again of Motley Crue. And that's the whole movie, pretty much.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah, so to make this not just a kind of a short review, what I find interesting about this movie, so this is directed by Jeff Tremaine, and you probably don't know the name of that director for most people listening here. That's the director of Jackass, believe it or not. So,
no, like I believe it.
Oh, yeah,
the stunts are this very similar. They reminded me of Jackass, actually. That's funny you bring that up.
Well, that's the thing, is that this movie so wants to be Jackass mixed with a biopic, because it is gross. This is a hard, like, for anyone who complained, like, oh man, they didn't show the nastier sides of Queen or the darker sides of certain stories. This movie lays everything out on the table. This is a hard R-rated movie with sex, drugs, profanity, wall-to-wall, you know, just insane stuff all throughout, at least the good first half of this movie.
I'd say the envelope hasn't just been pushed, it's been burned into an ash and then snorted.
Gosh, that's just, even that sentence alone has so many references to stuff in the movie that actually happens. It's like, I can believe it.
Yeah. Now, as you said, did you come close to throwing up at any time during this movie?
Oh my God. Okay, I'm going to say this. For people listening, there are two major sequences in this movie that will literally pull at your gag reflex. One happens very early on in the movie, and believe it or not, that's an actual event that happened from their memoir, or at least based on a real person from their memoir. So you know the scene I'm talking about, Bradley, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, but then there's the other major scene, which I'm just going to say this. It's the scene where the actor playing Ozzy Osbourne plays a cameo, which is played by, believe it or not, the guy who apparently is the lead actor on the School of Rock Nickelodeon TV show.
Wow.
Yeah, don't expect any Nickelodeon antics with this dude, because that scene by itself, I was like my wife and I were watching this. I was literally at the point of almost throwing up. Yeah,
it's been a week and I'm starting to get gag memories.
Yeah, but we should focus on the main actors in here, because the four lead players here, we got Douglas Booth playing Nikki Six. We got, I always forget how to pronounce this guy's name, Ewan Rian, you know, Ramsay Bolton from Game of Thrones. He's playing Mick Mars. Daniel Weber, who's playing Vince Neil, and then Machine Gun Kelly playing Tommy Lee, which is not who I would have expected to play this part. But, you know, obviously the bulk of this movie really hinges on these four guys as, you know, the main characters. And, you know, I'm kind of mixed on this ensemble. Like, okay, let me just say this. Of the people in the cast here, Bradley, who did you find to be the most interesting?
I actually, for cast, as in performances, I liked Daniel Weber the best.
Yeah, no, I'm surprised, because, you know, to be fair, Vince already had a lot of the most interesting details of what happened in his life. I mean, I say interesting, also horribly tragic and dramatic on top of that.
Oh, but I see what you're saying. He had the most, he was given the most range. Not had it, but he was given the most opportunity to show that.
Well, that's the funny thing is, like, at some point in the movie, he kind of becomes the main character, even though technically Nikki Six is the main character, like, ostensibly, I guess, you know? And that's just because so much stuff happened to Vince near the end of this phase of their life that it's hard not to cover that stuff for the bulk of the story.
No, absolutely. And the most interesting things about Tommy Lee, or even the most, surprisingly enough, notorious things about Tommy Lee were after they kind of left Motley Crue, so
we miss out
on all of that. So he's the buffoon, but he still does really good. But yeah, there he has nothing to do, since Tommy Lee's crazy moments in his life were after the film in the 90s, where the film could care less. You
know? See, that's the thing, is that actually they cut out a bunch of details about him, which, oddly enough, the movie turns to the camera and openly admits that they didn't cover everything in the movie, which is one of the weirder sequences in this film. But there's actually a bunch of stuff they cut out. Like, they didn't mention Pamela Anderson once in this point, even though by the time the movie ends, him and Pamela are already married for a good, like, 6 months in the movie, in real life. So it's like, wait, did we forget that? But I'm pretty sure Pamela Anderson just saw the script, just like, nope, I am putting my foot down. You are not putting me in this movie.
No, you're probably right. By that time, you're exactly right. When the movie ends, he would already have been with Pamela, and he would already have starred in that boat film that a lot of people have seen. But it's completely ignored.
Yeah, so I sense there was some meddling in that one. But, you know, honestly, I got to say, like, I do agree that I think of the two most interesting people that I liked in this movie in terms of performances were Daniel Weber, because, again, he had to carry a lot of the dramatic weight in this movie. And oddly enough, gosh dang, Machine Gun Kelly is really good in this movie. Like, I was shocked, because I don't think he's ever acted in anything else before, but he seemed like, you know, actually, well, I guess he's been, like, bit parts in, like, smaller projects leading up to this, because he had he had a bit part in Bird Box earlier this last year. Oh.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, but here it feels like, of everyone else in the movie, he seemed to be the most hungry to get a good performance in this movie. You know, like, he clearly was like, look, this is a leading role. I'm playing an iconic musician. I can't mess this up. And while that does translate a little bit into his performance, it kind of fits, because that feels like how Tommy Lee is, or at least based on what I know about Tommy Lee, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, he clearly is an incredibly talented musician. I think what was interesting about, and what I don't think they gave Machine Gun Kelly a lot to work with, but he does carry the scenes he's in, at least.
Oh, yeah. Well, a lot of his scenes are the craziest scenes. No, like, maybe not, like, the most, like, graphic or anything like that, but they're definitely the showier, goofier sequences.
Right. Kind of thing. But Tommy Lee, his emotions are on, like, a tightrope, and we only get to see that maybe in two or three scenes of the movie, which, it has a lot to cover, because there are four band members that are pretty iconic in their own right. But I was surprised at the lack of his story. And maybe that's just because I was kind of getting into adolescence in the 90s, so I know a lot about Tommy Lee and his crazy antics. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, and then that's the thing, too, though, that with all the stuff that's going on for Vince and Tommy Lee in the story, it feels like, especially Mick Mars, is barely a presence in this film. Because, I mean, I guess maybe this is more true to history, that he was kind of the guy who had more sense on his shoulders kind of thing. But honestly, you expect with him being the most high-profile actor in this cast, that you'd give Ewan Rian more to do in the plot, right?
Yeah.
But no, most of the scenes, he's just kind of sitting there going, I got a spinal problem, and you guys are all idiots. Mm.
Yes. Spinal problem, you're all a bunch of boneheads. We're all going to die out here. He was fine, but no, I agree with you. Not much for him to do.
Yeah, and then Douglas Booth, I think he fluctuates on how interesting he is. Because, I mean, you know, it seems like, again, based on the history of this, it was him... Vince and Tommy, they were just the bonehead, horny morons in the story. And yeah. Nikki, at least, it seems like Nikki, of all people, had the most, like, psychological reasoning for why he was messed up. Because the film starts with his flashbacks about his horrible childhood with his mom and her abusive boyfriends and all the stuff he did with his dad disowning him. And, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, inherently you feel, wow, this guy's, you know, his origin is really freaking terrible. But then, at some point, you kind of... This goes more into the major problem I have with the structure of this film, because the first half of this movie is just insane energy. Like, just, you know, it's the high life of Motley Crue during the peak of their formation and their, you know, most famous part of their career, where they're just, you know, snorting coke, banging hookers, banging groupies, banging pretty much anything with a hole, it seems like.
Yeah, probably the sofa by the end of the party, you know.
I'm sure that sofa's been thoroughly soaked and abused by the end of the story. But then there comes a point when the, you know, like all good biopics where it's like, oh, but now here's the part where things start to turn around on them. Where the movie really starts to kind of drain in terms of energy. And it's still dramatic stuff going on, but it feels like it's missing that spark that made the first half actually kind of work more than it didn't.
No, I agree with you. It seems to lack a lot of heart. There's a sequence towards the end when Nikki Sixx is like to one of the other bandmates, I won't spoil it, he's like, you're my best friend, man. And I remember thinking, is he his best friend? I don't really get that relationship or feel that between them. What did you think?
Well, that's the problem with this movie, is that it makes some presumptions that you already know stuff about Motley Crue before you get into the story. Because, I mean, admittedly, I don't know much about Motley Crue. Most of what I've learned I've had to look up for this movie. But there's that point where they go like, oh, Motley Crue, no stranger to controversy. I'm like... Well, we've seen them do crazy antics, but we've never seen people react to them as being a controversial band, you know? Like, that was the first time, like, you know, what, 30 minutes into the movie where they go, oh, they're a controversial band. It's like, okay, if you say so. But then, you know, there's other stuff, too, because they're covering such a broad range, because we start at, like 1979 or some really early point, and then we skip, you know, to the end. I mean, like, by the end of the movie, we're at, like, 1995. So you're covering 20 years of history, more or less, in this story, and... You know, it's just some parts they feel they really need to emphasize, and some parts they're just kind of like, eh, you kind of know what's going on here. Don't worry.
Well, I want to ask you about that as well. You said you had to research Motley Crue for this. Now, I know, and pretty much everybody knows, Shout at the Devil, and of course, Dr. Feelgood. Did you get any other hits from this?
I know Motley Crue, mostly because I got exposed to this through that video game Brutal Legend, where they featured Motley Crue songs prominently in that. But, you know, I discovered a bunch of songs, and even some of the songs they're playing in the background here, I'm just like, wait, I know that one, and I know that one, and I know that one. And it's like, yeah, Motley Crue did have a great variety of, like, maybe not always number one hits, but some very, like, notable metal songs. Like, you know, if you're into that kind of 80s hairband metal stuff. But... That's also the thing, too, is that, you know, for as much... I mean, because apparently, you know, they actually did rehearse and play a good number of the songs of this. I'm sure it wasn't full... Like, they did lip-sync a little bit for some of the songs, but it seemed like they really rehearsed to make sure that it sounded and felt authentic as possible. But, you know, it's just like most of these kind of rock biopics, where it's very much like, you know, hey, it's the greatest hits of this band's music. Even up to the point before the band's even formed, they're already playing Motley Crue music in the background.
You know? That's true.
Yeah. But then that also attributes to some of the weird directorial and writing choices this movie does, because most of it's a pretty straightforward, like, you know, again, it's a rock biopic directed by the Jackass guys. You know, it's just, it's anarchic. It's kind of flatly shot throughout most of it, but it's still got a certain style and energy, much like those Jackass movies did. But then it'll do weird narrative structure choices, like, you know, the whole thing where they switch narrators throughout this movie, because, yes, a lot of this movie is narrated, for people who aren't listening. I mean, who didn't know that?
All four of them narrated at least once, right?
They all took turns. And apparently, from what I learned, is that's because the book is written in that format. It's almost Rashomon style, where they'll recount certain events and they go, well, I remember this happening here. And they go, no, I remember it doing like this. So they wanted to capture that kind of spirit with the storytelling. And sometimes that worked, and sometimes it's just like, I mean, there's so many people speaking here, and they all sound the same at some point, so I can't tell who's speaking or why I should care when someone starts to take over, you know? And it's not that the stuff they're showing isn't interesting, it's just a strange stylistic choice. And then at some point, they start breaking the fourth wall, talking to the audience about stuff. And I'm like, okay, but they only do it like twice, maybe three times in the movie, and it's never really that big a deal whenever they do it.
No, that's true. I mean, breaking the fourth wall is supposed to be fun, and here it just kind of seemed like, hey, everybody having a good time? Motley Crue.
Well, I felt like Jet Tremaine watched The Big Short, and he goes, oh, I can do that. Because there's a point,
that's a good point.
Literally, there's a point where Ewan Rhiannon looks to the camera and goes, yeah, so this scene never actually happened because we met Doc at a bar, and there's another character that we were supposed to introduce in this, but we didn't have time to put him in the movie, so we cut him out. And I'm like, wait. You've acknowledged that you're in a movie. But that's the only time this movie ever acknowledges that they're part of a movie.
Right.
So,
and the rest, it's just narration as narration is. You know, I think Nikki Sixx's character, Douglas Booth, and Machine Gun Kelly had the highlights of the narration.
Oh, sure. Personally. Like, they had the most story. Because that's the thing. It's like, Vince's stuff happens really near the end, where it's all the really heavy, awful stuff that occurred. Because, I mean, for people who probably don't know, I mean, it's in the history. It's just that, you know, he had a situation with vehicular manslaughter where he got someone killed, and then his daughter. A really, really tragic story there. And to be fair, I'd feel more empathetic if also I didn't feel bad saying, oh, I feel so sad, but this daughter's a really terrible actor. So, you know, just like...
Well, that's where I think why Daniel Weber was the best actor in this. Because the daughter, I mean, this actress is kind of just a prop. Like, hi, you have a daughter. Her dialogue might as well be that, hey, you have a daughter, huh?
And so the dialogue is written that directly, too, which is a bit of a problem. Yes. Where they're like, guys, you're an old man, you're a druggie, you're a kid drummer, but we're a family. And I'm just like, all right, thank you, movie.
Like, Daniel as Vince shows the utmost care and love for this young actress. I'm not going to bash on a little kid actress. Of course.
I know.
It's like Bradley Cooper with that fake doll in American Sniper. And that's a criticism and not a criticism, because Bradley Cooper, he acts the shit out of that scene. You really think he's holding a real baby, and then you're like, what? But that's not a real baby. But it's kind of like that. And I think Daniel Weber carries that tragedy very well. I'd love to hear his process on how he got into the headspace of someone who suffers from that kind of loss. I really liked, too, as I said, the narration of Machine Gun Kelly's I Don't Remember. Like, that's my favorite sequence in the movie.
Oh, yeah, the very clearly Goodfellas / Wolf of Wall Street inspired sequence. It's a weird POV sequence where you watch him going around like, you know, here's my daily routine. 5:30 p.m., wake up, you know, 6 o'clock, get to the studio. And it's, you know, again, it's literally that scene from Wolf of Wall Street where he recounts his drug-induced agenda and an itinerary, you know?
Right. Now, do you think, though, that's why it's such a disjointed movie, because it moves from one homage to a better movie to the next?
Oh, they are speeding along, like, throughout this plot, trying to cover, okay, we need to get to this part, and this part, and this part, and this part. And then also, stylistically, they're going, all right, so we want this scene to be like Big Short, but then we want this scene to be like Bohemian Rhapsody, but then we want this scene to be like this. And in some ways, I kind of like that, because it's so different than other biopics, where it's like, yeah, they're trying hard to really stylistically change things up. But on the other hand, it also made things very disjointed at certain points. And especially once it hits the second half, most of that stylistic stuff starts to disappear, you know? Where it's just like, oh, well, now we're just getting a very traditional rock biopic after this point.
Yeah, which I thought was disappointing. By the end of it, when you get to the final curtain call, I actually felt like, is that all there is? This movie doesn't end, or at least it's not intended to end on a, and that's a rock star for ya. But that's how I felt, you know. It's supposed to end in triumph with how the music was playing and how they were like, yeah. But I felt like, wow, what a shitty life Thanks, Netflix. Well,
that's the funny thing is, like, this movie seems to be about, you know, the, because I remember we talked about this trailer on Breakfast Club a while back. It's like, yeah, it seems like it's going to cover, you know, the hard life of a rocker, where it's like, yeah, they lose loved ones, they lose families because of their partying antics. And I mean, you know, I mentioned to you through a chat at one point that this is clearly a movie about people with more testosterone or brain cells, because they're hellions throughout certain parts of this movie. Like, literally, I'm sure they didn't even cover half of this stuff that's actually in the book, and I'm assuming it's probably even worse than the stuff they're showing. And it was pretty bad when you watch it in the movie itself. But, I don't know. I felt like by the end, I didn't learn anything from it. And I don't feel like they learned anything from it.
It's like,
It sucked. You know, the parts that sucked, but, you know, you expect it. It's like, okay, and then nothing ever bad happened again to Motley Crue, even though they were performing 20 years after the fact and other stuff happened in their lives.
Yeah, I suppose that's realistic, though, that it didn't end on a happy note. Or at least a presumed happy note.
It ended on kind of like a optimistic note, but it's like, yeah, but that leaves tons of history.
We know that, we know it's not smooth sailing.
Yeah, but, you know, there's other stuff in this movie. I mean, there's not a whole lot for the other, you know, people in the movie. Like, what? There's a cameo by Christian Gehring playing David Lee Roth, which was kind of a slightly funny scene, you know, where he shows up. And then you also got this great character actor I love, David Costabile, who plays their manager, Doc. You know, he's the guy who's, like, from Breaking Bad. He was Gale in that show, and he pops up in a bunch of stuff as, like, you know, timid, nerdy guys usually. But he kind of has a bit to show off. Like, you know, they give him nothing to do in the movie, but he makes the most with the little scenes he has. And then one of the cameos that kind of surprised me in here, Pete Davidson shows up from SNL as the guy who recruited Motley Crue, like, their first manager.
Yeah.
Which, as if this movie couldn't be more trying to be Bohemian Rhapsody, they find the guy who looks totally like Rami Malek to show up in this movie.
Well, he's got the teeth, you know.
And the eyes.
He's not wearing a prosthetic. Yeah. The teeth and the eyes.
Yeah. And I'm just like...
You know what? He even gets to break the fourth wall. That reminds me of...
That was...
Before the concert. Yeah, that was... Odd choice.
Which, again, this also proves that Motley Crue may be the horniest band I have ever seen in my life. Like, literally, if you are a woman and you are anywhere near a member of Motley Crue, they're going to try to have sex with you. Like, yeah. They don't care if you're married. They don't care if you're dating other members of the band. They're going to try to get into your pants. And they make that point very clear throughout the entire movie.
Oh, yeah, very much. Which, so. Depending on how much they've had to drink or snort, who knows what's going to happen. That's the craziest thing.
I'll say this, like, you know, other than just being a freshly married man, the sex in this movie, one, it's very in your face. You know, like, they don't leave much to the imagination at all in this movie. But
no, it's not pretty. It is not pretty.
And that's the thing. It's like they expect it to be titillating. Like, oh man, it's the rock lifestyle with boobs and butts
it's
and that stuff.
Filthy.
It's gross. It is the way that they show sex in this movie. It is not glamorous at all. I'm surprised they didn't go more in depth of like, yeah, Tommy Lee and those guys. I'm sure they have massive piles of STDs on their junk now. Seriously.
Oh my goodness.
Seriously. I mean, like, they even asked at one point, they talked to Vince because he's the horniest of them all. They're just like, so man, how many ladies have you slept with? Oh, I don't know. 3, 4. No, not just today. I mean the entire tour. Oh, I can't even count that much.
I don't know, man.
Yeah. So I don't know. That's the thing where, I mean, I can accept ugly movies like that, but it is one of those things where when you get so much of that, you know, thrown at you constantly throughout the film, it does start to kind of wear you out where I'm just like, gosh, how much more can I take of this? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So
it's a razor's edge, man.
It is indeed. So I don't know. Like I'm in a weird spot where, I mean, this movie's not getting the most positive reviews from people. And I have to assume a lot of it comes from people who know or like Motley Crue and know that, yeah, this movie can't possibly cover everything that covered in the book, you know?
Yeah. And it's a pretty, you know, notorious book as well. The thing about the film and the book is after watching the film, I haven't read the book, mind you, it kind of makes me wonder how reliable these kind of drug addicts are. I'm not saying that none of this happened, but like, do any of them actually know what was really going on?
Well, that's the thing is that
and purges?
That's the thing with a bunch of the fact-checking stuff is that even some of the people involved in the story don't remember if certain things happened or not. Like, I think, you know, especially the...
That doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, the Ozzy cameo, that whole sequence. Apparently, Ozzy is not going to say that he didn't say that stuff didn't happen, but he can't remember if it did happen or not, you know?
Oh, yeah. And I could see Ozzy say, yeah, Ozzy, like, oh, you know, I mean, I don't think I did, but I don't think I wouldn't do it, you know?
Which, I'm just going to say this, Ozzy... I just hope you don't remember this, because I don't want that image burned in anyone else's brains.
Oh, yeah, that's a tough scene to watch.
It is, indeed. So, I think that's all I got to really say about this movie. I feel conflicted, and I'll just segue to my final thoughts with this. I felt like, for the most part, I had this weird kind of, like, schadenfreude about this movie, where I'm like, I'm kind of enjoying watching these people go through the ups and downs of just this hellish existence of rock stars. It's not showing me anything new I've never seen in a rock biopic before, but it's not doing anything badly. In fact, it's got some good sequences, some good jokes, some good, you know, moments. It's just very familiar territory that they're treading, you know? It's like, yeah, the only thing that's different is the insane antics Motley Crue got themselves into. I mean, like, I'm surprised they didn't go to jail more for some of the stuff they did in this movie, you know?
No, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so... At the end of the day, though, I have to think about the stuff of how I felt near the end, and I felt pretty gross by the end of this story, because it goes to some dark places near the last third act. Yeah. So I think I'm going to have to give this 6 out of 10, 6 out of 10 ant snorted. Which, by the way, people, that sequence is the thumbnail on the movie's thing on Netflix. So you'll see what happens when you watch that sequence.
No. Oh, Netflix, don't show your hand.
I know, right? So then what would you say, Bradley?
Well, I was on board with this for about 10 minutes. it reminds me of, let me explain that. That sounded a bit harsh. Like, you know that Rick and Morty episode where he's like, Morty, they're going to purge. Let's watch The Purge.
Yeah.
And he watches The Purge for about 10 seconds and says, whoa, 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 whoa. I didn't want to see that. And, you know, and he says, maybe we should leave, Morty.
Wait, and so I'm amazed you made it that far, even after one of the grossest parts of the whole movie happens in literally the first minute.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So I was like, whoa, this looks like how rock stars act, and then something happens right away, and then I'm like, oh no. Why did I want this, you know? But I thought it was interesting how Vince Neil, the character, Daniel Weber, again, I've just been praising him the whole movie. Sorry, guys.
No, he's great. He's great in this movie.
You know, yeah. I liked that he was all, oh, I want to be a rock star, you know, so I can do sex and drugs. And that, I think, set up the most interesting part of the rock biopic. I haven't seen many of them, but usually it's, oh, I was for the music and the love of playing, and then I was seduced by the drugs. And I always think when biopics say that, it's kind of nonsense. And it was refreshing to hear, finally, these, like, notorious rock stars say, no, we want to be famous for the sex and drugs.
We want to get to the drugs. And we brought the sex and drugs. Now we're going to get to the music.
Right, exactly. Yeah. That's our end goal, is the most sex and the most drugs. Because that seems more honest to me. So I was kind of taken aback as it gets into the third act, where Nikki Sixx is like, oh no, I let myself be seduced by sex and drugs. And I was just thinking, what? You wanted that. You weren't seduced. You dove head first off the diving board into an empty pool, man.
I get it in the sense that, you know, based on his origin and what we saw about it, that he was using sex and drugs to, you know, channel his frustrations. But it did feel like...
Yeah, that's a good point.
It felt like the sudden twist that he makes near the end of like, oh no, now I know why I really wanted to do this, does feel a little... incongruent with his motivations.
Yeah. Well, before I get into another rant, I'm going to say I give this 6 forgotten memories on 10 band tours across the world.
And man, they toured. Like, when you see there's that one part where they just go through the entire tour that they did in like the 90s or like 1990, I'm amazed that any of them were like alive after that. And in fact, there's a point in the movie where they think that one of the characters died, and for all intents and purposes, he was pretty much dead by that point in that story.
Was that being played as funny, or...? I'm not sure.
Like, darkly humorous, I guess? Because it's like...
No, yeah, I guess that's true. I mean, I didn't mean to laugh. I knew he was going to be... I knew he was going to be okay, so maybe that's why I thought it was so funny. But,
Well, I mean, also, they use that purely to make a Pulp Fiction reference at one point, too. You're like, I know where this is going. Actually, you know what? I gotta give props. The best extra in this movie was that one black ER guy that was working on him. He's like, you know, they're like, all right, calling it time of death. And the guy's like, F that. This is freaking Nikki Sixx. He's not dying in my ambulance.
Yeah.
So that dude, you get a big high five and a bump. Come on, man.